Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Quick hits. Satellite classes. The Permian Basin Adult Literacy Center has scheduled satellite English language learning and computer literacy classes from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Wednesdays, January 8th through April 29th at Odessa Bible Church, 3901 Pembroke. Students are required to pay a once-yearly enrollment fee of $25. For more information, call 682-9693 or email hsmith@pbalc.org. Hope and healing. Virtually every industry association, local and state governments, first responders, community leaders, and activists will gather, joining together for what undoubtedly will be a time of hope and healing, January 16th at the La Hacienda Event Center. The evening will begin with a donor-sponsored black tie and boots benefit dinner, followed by a hope and healing community concert featuring Rick Trevino and Clay Walker. A portion of the proceeds from the dinner and concert will be donated to the Odessa Community Foundation's August 31st Fund, a 501c3 Odessa-based nonprofit formed by the Odessa Chamber of Commerce and benefiting the families of 7 deceased and 25 injured. For more information about the benefit dinner or to make a donation, email hope@basinstrong.com. Go online for tickets or sponsor tables. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. Section A. Journalist looks back at 2019's Best Images by Mark Rogers. The year 2019 was an interesting photography year for me. I like making images that allow you to feel the emotion of the people in my pictures. I loved the decisive moment of the leaping boy and his shadow in the St. Mary's Central Catholic School musical hula PE class. This image also has a feeling of innocent youth that most of us have experienced in our own lives or the lives of our children. I photographed a two-car accident on JBS Parkway in February that left one car upside down on the side of the road. The driver was shaken but not injured and was sitting on the curb waiting for the police to finish their investigation. She was being comforted by her husband and a friend. I love this image because of the human touch and compassion being shown. In December, I photographed Brenda Grimsley and her husband Brad Grimsley, who was shot by Seth Ader during Ader's August 31st mass shooting. I felt chills as she leaned over and mimicked a gun with her hand to describe exactly what she saw when Ader leaned over in a stolen mail truck and shot her husband. My favorite photo of the year was made during the 2019 UIL Region 6 marching contest at Ratliff Stadium in October. I love the challenge of walking around an event looking for visually interesting things to photograph. Outside the stadium, I found the area where the twirlers were competing. When I saw Monahan's High School twirler, Hope Santiago, waiting to perform, I knew I had to photograph her. I loved her enthusiasm and her wonderful expression. If I could give any advice to other photographers out there, it would be to be ready when that great image happens in front of you. When you get to the place you want to take pictures, first make sure your camera settings are correct for the situation you are shooting in. Use a faster shutter speed to stop action. Use a wider aperture to slightly blur the background to make your subject stand out more. Try not to center your subject in the center of the frame. Most importantly, be patient when you are taking photos. Find your subject and keep shooting until you get that perfect slice of life moment. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. Section D, Life and Times. OC Creates Barber Crossover Program by Ruth Campbell. Partly because of demand for hot shaves, razor cuts, and all the designs that can be created with them, Odessa College has opened a barber crossover school. Cherie Shepherdson, cosmetology department chair, said the barber school hasn't been offered before, but the demand has been strong. Classes began in July 2019. We have the barber crossover right now, which is you have to have your cosmetology license, and then the barber crossover is a 300-hour program. Basically, we're teaching the shave. We're adding to men's cutting and grooming for that 300-hour program, Shepherdson said. Our advisory committee has been asking for it for 8 years that I know of, she added. 18 of the 25 available spots are filled, and 2 students have graduated and are now licensed. Because of having to have their cosmetology license, they're already working in the shop, Shepherdson said. This is so they can use a straight blade with no guard. Shepherdson said students who are graduating right now are already asking if they can enroll in the barber crossover program. She tells them they are welcome to come back after they have their cosmetology license. The only difference between cosmetology and barbering is that straight blade with no guard. When you look at the curriculum, that's really the only difference, she said. Shepherdson said cosmetology students learn hair, makeup, nails, hair extensions, eyelash extensions, and nail extensions, among other skills. We've got a really high pass rate, and they're really successful, she added. Shepherdson said there is a local private barber school, but OC can make it more affordable. I think some of our cosmetology people are a little hesitant on men's cutting, some of the tighter fades, so it gives them a little more one-on-one instruction because it is a smaller class. Students use balloons initially to get the angle for shaving. There's not a lot of people that do the traditional hot shave anymore in the barber shop, and so I think with the barber crossover, we're going to bring back the traditional hot shave, she said. OC Executive Director of Marketing and Communications, Frank Rich, said hot shaves are becoming an upper-end trend. Shepherdson said it could easily be a weekly or monthly treat. She added that there are a lot of barbers coming to the Permian Basin from other parts of Texas because they've found they can make more money here. You just have to put in the hours, especially with cutting. You have your tools, but once you pay for your tools, the service relatively is costing you time, so you're paying for time and skill level, Shepherdson said. The barber crossover program is an evening course. They will offer it during the day during the summer. Barbering still has to be separated from cosmetology under state laws and regulations, she said. Students offer a variety of styling and cutting services to the public from 9 to 11 a.m. and 1 to 4 p.m. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Barber crossover students provide services to clients from 5 to 9 p.m. Luis Gonzalez, Associate Dean of Continuing Education, said the Barber Crossover Program is currently being offered through Continuing Education, but at some point they would like to make it a credit program. Continuing education allows us to meet the immediate demand. Then it gives us time also to see what the program is going to look like long term and if we can bring it into a credit program, he said. To become a credit course, Rich said it also has to go through the accreditation process from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. Donna Kilgore, an instructor in the Barber Crossover Program and Cosmetology, said the Barber Crossover is another chance for more students to be trained. Kilgore said she has been an instructor at OC for 7 years and has been doing hair for about 17 years. I think The night program helps out a lot, since there are a lot of people who work during the day. It gives them an opportunity to come in and go to school and maybe change their field and not have to be out there in the hot sun. Now they can come in and actually be in the air conditioning. It's a lucrative business, she said. New Year's Resolutions. A Healthier 2020 by Heather Massey, Regional Director of the Better Business Bureau in the Permian Basin. The new year and decade are here. A new year provides a fresh start and an opportunity for people to assess what they'd like to do better in the coming months. A blog that conducted a survey in 2017 of 400 people in the U.S. and the U.K. found exercising more and eating healthier were the most common New Year's resolutions, respectively. Of the survey participants, 45% set their resolutions with the hope of improving their quality of life, and 23% wanted to lose weight. Becoming healthier is often one of the most popular resolutions each year, and there are many ways of accomplishing this. The American Psychological Association, APA, says unaccomplished resolutions can quickly bring anxiety and suggests starting small and asking for support. Your Better Business Bureau is here with these tips to support you on your journey to a happy, healthy 2020. Get fit with the right gym. New gym memberships increase at the beginning of January when consumers decide to invest in a gym and their health. There can be many benefits to working out at a public gym: classes, equipment, accountability, and more. However, you want to be sure you're at the place that's right for you. Knowing your fitness goals and setting priorities can help you determine where to start looking. Always take a tour of facilities and read the contract closely to determine how much a membership costs each month. You can also check the gym's business profile on BBB.org. Watch for free trial scams. Some health and fitness goals, like quitting smoking or losing weight, can be a slow process. You may even feel like you aren't making much progress, which is when turning to miracle products begins to seem like a good idea. First and foremost, you should always be careful when taking products for your health and should consult with your doctor first. Second, products using big claims and celebrity endorsements may be attempting to lure you into a free trial scam. This is when a company claims it'll send you a sample of its product for free. You just need to give your credit card information to pay shipping and handling. Later, you find a charge for the full cost of the product. If this is the direction you decide to go when working on your New Year's resolutions, always read the terms and conditions carefully before placing your order and use your credit card for extra protections. Care for your mental health, too. Caring for your health extends beyond your physical health. HelpGuide.org emphasizes the importance of social connection when caring for your mental health. In fact, a report released by Better Business Bureau at the end of September showed social isolation to be a factor in increasing scam risk. Those with fewer people in their lives to discuss potential scam offers with were more likely to become victims of fraud and lose money. Take time this year to connect with old friends and meet new ones, too. Have a happy and healthy new year from everyone here at the Better Business Bureau, serving the heart of Texas. Opinion. Our view. Empty stocking was generously filled by you. The point. We thank Odessans for always coming through for the Salvation Army and the Empty Stocking Fund during the holidays for 25 years now. Friends and neighbors once again blessed friends and neighbors this holiday season by donating to the Empty Stocking Fund. The $100,000 goal seemed very far away when the fund started Thanksgiving Day 2019, but that fear of not meeting the goal to help the Odessa Salvation Army was soon erased. In fact, The empty stocking fund beat the goal with a final tally of $124,015. This was year 25 of partnering with the Salvation Army for the Empty Stocking Fund, which is used to fund holiday food baskets and small gifts for children and seniors in need in Odessa. The charitable event has always been our pleasure. We are always amazed and humbled by the generous spirit of folks around here. This year was particularly special to us as it was our silver anniversary of 25 years of asking for your help. We reflected on how the fund started in 1995 and raised $28,895 that year. Since the Empty Stocking Fund was created in Odessa, we have raised more than $2 million, with year 2019 in the books. That makes us all proud, not of ourselves, but of you, our readers. You guys are the ones who make this work. We've seen the fund go up some years and then back down some years. We didn't quite make the $30,000 goal in 1995, but we sure got close. Since that time, we've met our goal most years. Last year, the goal was $100,000, and we came up about $24 over that amount. We know that there are so many great causes and charities out there vying for our time and money. This year, 250 families with about 500 children were aided this Christmas season. We thank you for your donations and for putting those in need at the top of your giving list. We have been fortunate that a lot of caring folks have put this cause on their annual schedule, and they are faithful at getting their donations to the Salvation Army in time for these disadvantaged children and families to have something to appreciate about the holidays. We are more than happy to list the names of contributors and any people or causes they choose to honor with their money, but we also understand if they want to do so anonymously, and we'll list the donation as such. We also appreciate businesses and individuals who make the Empty Stocking Fund their primary charitable donation. A generous Odessan challenged business owners to a $35,000 match that made all of the donations during the final week of fundraising go a bit farther. The great thing about giving to the Empty Stocking Fund is the fact that even the smallest donation matters. All of those involved with the effort appreciate the individual donations, but our thankfulness is nothing compared to the gratitude of those who benefit. We thank you all for the last 25 years. Here's to 25 more. Hints from Heloise. Use grapefruit spoon to scoop out pepper seeds. Dear Heloise, I always had a problem when I cleaned peppers. I never could get all the seeds out. I seemed to work forever to get them all out, but always had a lot left. I don't know how I found this out, but now I use a grapefruit spoon, and it works like a charm. Just scrape the inside of the pepper, and out they come. Big D in Ohio. A New Year's Cleaning. Dear Heloise, with a new year comes the desire to clean out my pantry in the kitchen. It's a great time to get rid of those foods that are out of date or those that have been invaded by insects, usually weevils. I use a cup of bleach to a gallon of water to wash down the shelves. Then I dry them and return the food to the pantry. Everything is organized and clean for the new year. Maisie J., Klamath Falls, Oregon. Maisie, that's a great idea. To all my readers, I wish for you a happy and healthy 2020. Heloise. Sweet Cement. Dear Heloise, after years of having my brown sugar turn into cement once it was opened, I found a solution. I sealed it in a vacuum sealer, and voila, even after a month or two, it is still soft. I thought others might find this helpful. Pat C., Bessemer, Alabama. Cherry Surprise. Dear Heloise, please reprint your Cherry Surprise recipe. I haven't made it in a long time and have forgotten how, but it was the special request of my son who is coming home on leave from the military. Carrie in Mississippi. Carrie, anything for our men and women in uniform. You'll need to cream together 2 sticks of butter or margarine and 2 cups sugar. Beat 3 eggs and add into the butter-sugar mixture. Mix in 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 2 teaspoons almond extract, and 1 pint sour cream. Then add 3 cups flour, 1 teaspoon baking soda, and 1/2 teaspoon salt. Mix to blend. Last, stir in 1 cup chopped maraschino cherries and 1 1/2 cups chopped nuts. Bake in a greased and floured tube pan at 325 degrees Fahrenheit for about 1 to 1.5 hours. When the cake has cooled, sprinkle with powdered sugar. FYI, when using powdered cake mix, put the water in the bowl first, then the dry mix. This helps prevent powder pockets at the bottom of the bowl. Heloise. Handy hints. Dear readers, here are a few handy hints. Microwave a lemon for 12 to 14 seconds and you'll increase the juice it produces. Use latex gloves to open stubborn jar lids. Instead of using toothpicks for closing stuffed pork chops or chicken breasts, try raw spaghetti. It's edible. Heloise. Dear Abby, family pariah finds safety, but not security. Dear Abby, I have dysfunctional parents. For the sake of my sanity, I made the decision to remove them from my life. They have retaliated by spreading lies to immediate and extended family. I was supposed to get an apartment with my father to help him now that he is aging. However, he became violent and threatened to kill me. I moved away and am physically safe now. My problem is I'm now completely alone and a pariah on both sides of my family. These lodgings are temporary. I'm afraid they will fall through once family finds out where I am and poisons this very distant relative against me. How am I supposed to survive this? I have a job, but big deal if I have nothing to live for and no purpose. Anonymous escapee. Dear escapee, your chances of having a more permanent roof over your head will be better if you tell this relative everything you have told me before someone else gets to him or her. Your father appears to have serious mental problems you are not equipped to deal with, which may become apparent in the near future when he acts out against someone else. You made the right choice. Your family members may be angry because they are now the ones who have to take care of him, which is why they have started the smear campaign. People survive situations like yours by performing their jobs well enough to excel and making new friends along the way. It's called creating a family of choice. Most of the individuals who do it thrive because the relationships are healthy ones. You have much to live for and many happy times ahead, so please remember that and concentrate on a future filled with possibilities. If you do, it is what you will achieve. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been together for 15 years, married for 6. We have the best relationship. Everybody tells us how great we are together. We don't fight, and we support each other 100% with everything. While my husband isn't overweight, he does go back and forth from going to the gym to work out and eating healthy to stopping and putting the weight right back on. I honestly couldn't care less about the number on his scale. The problem is, he's a horrible snorer. It's awful. I usually end up moving to the couch in the middle of the night to get some sleep. I have tried earplugs, headphones, you name it. He has tried the strips, the sprays, mouth guards, been to the doctor, everything. He always feels bad when he wakes up and finds me out of the bed. I've told him that it doesn't make me mad. I just get annoyed when I have to get up and go. The only thing that seems to make a difference is when he loses weight. How do I tell him that if he lost some weight, he would snore less? I don't want to hurt his feelings. Sleeping badly in Ohio. Dear sleeping badly, if you have observed that your husband snores less when his weight is down, tell him. It isn't hurtful. It would be helpful. You say he's been to see his doctor. Ask if he's been checked for sleep apnea. If there are long pauses between a sleeping person's breaths or gasping, it could be a symptom of sleep apnea, a condition that can be life-threatening. A diagnosis could be a lifesaver. Wild about Texas. Sandhill cranes usually are heard before they are seen. By Michael Price. To the budding Texas naturalist, it would seem as though the winter months do not afford ample opportunities to view wildlife because of seasonal inactivity. However, this is not the case, especially when the goal is to view wildlife that occupies this area for the few brief weeks of what we call winter. One of these wildlife viewings is the spectacular sandhill crane. Although the primary range of the sandhill crane is in the northern portions of this continent during the summer months, where the species comes from, when the seasons there begin to change to the brutally cold winter, it makes its home in the temperate climates of the southern continental United States, including the western two-thirds of Texas. As the crane makes its migratory journey to and from its winter home, it flies communally, rarely, if ever, venturing far on its own. Often they will fly in a V formation, although occasionally they will fly in a straight line. Regardless of the formation they fly in, they will often be heard before they are seen, as they have a tendency to sound off in a nasally trumpet-like song that can be heard from as far off as a mile away. This species of crane is large and can achieve body lengths of up to 4 feet and wingspans that can approach a whopping 6 feet. At first sight, it seems to have an almost gangly appearance. This stately look is due to the long legs and neck, as well as the large, straight bill. This almost comical look is exaggerated when this animal takes flight, as it takes several steps with its long legs as it gains enough momentum to take to the air. In flight, the downstroke of the wings is very slow and methodical, while the upstroke is rapid and jerky. Distinguishing characteristics of this bird as an adult include the bright red crown of the head, white chin and cheeks, light gray body and wings, and the aforementioned long neck and legs. Sandhill cranes are omnivorous, meaning that its diet consists of plants as well as animals, such as fish, frogs, crustaceans, and insects. It utilizes its long legs to walk great distances through the shallow water of marshes and playas to search for food. It also roosts communally in these areas, typically standing upright through the night. While on its winter retreat, the males, which are larger than the females, will attempt to court its prospective mate by a noisy and conspicuous dance that consists of leaping up to 8 feet into the air while calling loudly and beating its wings. If the female is interested in mating, then she will join in with the male in this dancing display. After such breeding, the pair remains monogamous and mates for life, and then both return to their summer homes. Upon arrival, both sexes will prepare the nest for the two eggs, which are incubated by both parents for approximately 30 days. The young will take their first flight at about 2 months of age. As with many large birds, it was wantonly killed during the earlier parts of the last century. However, habitat loss from agricultural use has been the largest conservational concern to scientists, but its numbers seem to be stable and even increasing. The sandhill crane can be quite common in areas of the panhandle, with large groups congregating in playas south of Lubbock, as well as in portions of the northern Edwards Plateau, with other communal sites occurring near the town of Robert Lee. Parsley is More Than a Garnish, by Barbara Porsche of Permian Basin Master Gardeners. Now is a good time to get a head start on an herb garden at your house. You should be able to find parsley seeds or maybe transplants at the nurseries or box stores. Parsley is like a vitamin pill. It is rich in vitamins A, B, C, and is a good source of calcium, niacin, potassium, and magnesium. An added bonus is that it deodorizes your breath, especially after eating garlic or onions. If you get some seeds, now is an excellent time to sprinkle them in your garden or any sunny spot in a flower bed. With the recent rain and hopefully some more soon, all the seeds that fell in my garden have suddenly sprouted. That is an added benefit. Parsley reseeds easily. At least the flat leaf variety does. The curly leaf variety is not so prolific, but be sure to plant enough for the caterpillars and butterflies. They love it. Parsley is a true biennial. It grows leaves the first year, then blooms and reseeds the second year, so you can see that I hardly ever have a time when I cannot go out and pick some for cooking. If you have a lot or purchase some at a store, you can put it in a glass of water like a bouquet of flowers, and it will last several days there or in the fridge. There are many uses for parsley besides decorating a plate. It can be used in almost any type of vegetable dish. New potatoes tossed with chopped parsley is a traditional Easter dish at my house. It can be chopped and tossed with cooked rice. Almost any pesto recipe has parsley in the list of ingredients. A big handful of fresh leaves adds a crisp flavor to a regular green salad. The stems are more flavorful and can be added to soups, stews, and stuffings. When you get a parsley decoration on your dinner plate at a fancy restaurant, don't leave it there. Eat it. If you have questions about growing parsley, call the AgriLife office in Midland at 686-4700 for more information. Mason has a population of characters. By Tumbleweed Smith. Mason is a hill country town of 2,500 residents with a courthouse square that's hard to maneuver. It has an extremely dense population of characters. Perhaps that's what makes the town so interesting. You can hardly go there without having some type of unique experience. One of my favorite eating places is Crockett Keller's Guns and Grub restaurant on the square near the Odeon Theater. One side of his building is the restaurant. The other half is his gun store. Crockett has some of the best seafood I've ever eaten. That's right, seafood in Mason. Crockett spends 3 days getting his oysters ready. I spoke at the library in Mason recently and did a couple of interviews while I was in town. One was with Ethan West, a barber who walked the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail. Another was with Tony Plutino, a river guide who knows about the best places in Texas to go canoeing. I also interviewed Jan Appleby, who heads up the group restoring the elegant Sequist House, one of the first mansions in the Hill Country. It was built in the 1880s and has 22 rooms and 15 fireplaces. One of my early radio programs featured Mason County resident Fred Gibson, the author of Old Yeller. That set a high standard for future interviews in Mason. Mason is known as the gem of the Hill Country, maybe because topaz is found in the area. It also has an interesting number of people interested in making wine. The Bat Cave, just out of town, attracts visitors and scientists who study the nighttime scavengers. Fort Mason has created interest among people who research pioneer days. The city is a welcoming community and has many transplants from Austin and other places. They quickly assimilate and find things to do, working with the library, museum, chamber, or other organizations. The list of characters I've interviewed in or near Mason includes Bill O'Banion, who hit a golf ball 30 miles from Mason to another nearby town. Took him several strokes. Sculptor Bill Worrell lives on the Llano River, south of Mason, as does Laura Lewis, an artist who does murals in office buildings for Fortune 500 companies. Spider Johnson is an accomplished saw player. Gene Zetsch is well known for his wood carvings. Tom Hadley set high standards as a professional rodeo announcer. Tommy Splitgarber acted in some Hollywood movies. Ray Carrington taught fly fishing. I've done reports on Mason's Courthouse Clock, the Odeon Theater, where the world premiere of Old Yeller took place, the city's high number of tennis players, its historic homes, knife makers, store owners, photographers, entertainers, historians, storytellers, cowboys, and hunters. I interviewed one man long ago who took his pet llama for a walk around the courthouse square every evening. It just seemed like the normal thing to do. One man had a pet crow. Hector County Sheriff's Office receives cards from Cards for Kids. The Hector County Sheriff's Office received a box of holiday cards from Cards for Kids, a group that sends cards during the holiday season to children and communities affected by mass shootings. The group began sending cards after 58 people were killed in a shooting in Las Vegas, according to a letter shared by ECSO. This year, residents from 26 states and Canada sent in cards to be shared with affected communities, the letter states. "We hope that this brings a smile to your face and to your heart," wrote Jackie Schildkraut of Cards for Kids, "wishing you nothing but happiness, love, and laughter this holiday season." ECSO posted a video to their Facebook page of them opening the box of cards. Sheriff Mike Griffiths said in the video it was the most cards he'd seen in his life. "We've had kind of a rough year this year," Griffiths said in the video. "We're going to make 2020 a better year." Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. Section E. Culture. Art meets artificial intelligence. Austin artists explore new meaning in data, by Ho-Jun Choi of the Austin American Statesman. Walking into Julia Morton's art gallery in Austin is, in a word, trippy. The cozy space is full of otherworldly art filled with shapes, scratches, and swirls. Some of the works are still images, while others are videos. At first glance, none of it seems to make any kind of sense. People freeze. They're mesmerized. They literally won't move, Morton said. It's like they have to look, and from what I've been told, get their bearings. Morton's work is part of a budding art form, one that uses artificial intelligence, AI, to generate images and visuals. Dubbed generative art, the works are created through non-human systems, such as computers. Artists have used algorithms and computers to generate art as early as the 1950s. University of Texas art history professor Taylor Bradley said the infusion of AI into the generative art genre is a relatively new development. Across the country, there are shows going up all the time about digital art, AI-generated art, smart technologies, and what have you, she said. I think there is plenty of acceptance and excitement over this new medium. Despite its recent arrival on the scene, Bradley said the practice of using AI to create art reminds her of a period in art history when artisans and craftsmen used to hone their various skills to create beautiful vases and furniture. I think artists have always been engineers who are inventing, innovating, and pushing the limits of technology, she said. Before Morton opened her East 6th Street gallery, named the Generative Art Project, she was entrenched in the world of fashion. She has also worked as an art columnist in New York. Morton said the new brand of AI-powered generative art forces people to look inward for meaning rather than using external context. For the first time in my life, in a very overarching way, this work is arousing our self-awareness of our animalistic nature, Morton said. Many of the artists whose works are featured in the gallery will first collect data sets found in the real world. Then, through the use of artificial intelligence, AI, artists find patterns in data sets that can be incorporated into their work through visualization tools. Because the data is grounded in reality, Morton said, people gain a sense of familiarity even in generative art that looks completely abstract. You get a feeling that you're in the presence of a living, real thing, Morton said, and that changes both how you experience the work as well as how you try to understand it. Morton's husband, James Pricer, is a local artist who creates art with the help of artificial intelligence. For one of his works, Pricer used data that he collected from a person's life, including their blood pressure, heart rate, and information. Though his art is largely enabled by the analysis powered by artificial intelligence, Pricer says the final part of his process depends on something much more human. What tells me that I'm finished is when I have a very strong emotional reaction, he said. Pricer, who has a background in data science, says he had long wanted to find a way to communicate to others the meaning he found in numbers. Traditionally, in the art world, you either had representational art or abstract art. Just like bridging tech and art, I thought if I could bridge representation and abstraction, that would make it possible for me to communicate what I see and feel in the data. And it's turning out to be true, Pricer said. Joao Beira is the founder of Datagrama Visuals, a company based in Austin that organizes performances and exhibitions using AI-generated art. Beira came to the United States from his native Portugal about 10 years ago to pursue a doctoral degree in digital media at the University of Texas at Austin. I realized that even though Austin is in touch with the musical experience, visually there was not really much going on in terms of bringing new ideas and doing things outside the norm, he said. Beira said the lack of an existing community is not necessarily a hindrance. Rather, he said it presents more of a blank canvas that he and other generative artists can fill. Austin might not be the first city you think about when you think about this technology, but the fact that the scene does not yet exist helps us build a foundation to build something here, Beira said. He said he finds meaning in generative art that is inspired by nature. You can find, for example, how trees grow and how they generate branches, or how the scales of a fish are organized, he said. You can actually replicate these different patterns and algorithms, and you can generate them in real time. Beira uses different programs to create his works, such as Deep Dream, an artificial intelligence-enabled software created by Google engineer Alexander Mordvintsev that studies patterns in images and generates its own shapes and colors based on the patterns that it has identified. Beira's company also uses software created by an Austin-based company called Synesthesia Live to create visualizations at live music performances. None of the visuals are pre-programmed by Beira to look a specific way. The added element of unpredictability, he said, is what makes AI-generated art exciting for him. Beira said he hopes his art can help people gain a better understanding of human consciousness and, in the process, themselves. It's not so much me being the creator and the ideas I have in my head, Beira said. It's more about me being an architect, pulling all these things together and seeing where it takes me, because it's completely unpredictable how the machine learns to see the world, just like a child when it first starts to look around the world and begins making the notion of their own world.
Chance of snow is forecast. A cold spell this week is likely to bring snow to the area, according to the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service's 7-day forecast is showing a cold front is expected to move into the area this week, with low temperatures dropping into the 20s Tuesday and Wednesday nights. The forecast for Tuesday night calls for rain showers before 9 p.m., and then rain and snow showers are likely. The chance of snow showers continues into Wednesday morning, and then a chance of rain and snow showers is in the forecast Wednesday, when the high temperature is expected to top off at 38 degrees. The National Weather Service is calling for a 70% chance of precipitation on Tuesday night and a 30% chance on Wednesday. The National Weather Service reported a trace amount of snow on January 11th. The last time the National Weather Service showed snow accumulation more than a trace was December 8, 2016, when 0.3 inch was recorded. The last time 1 inch or more accumulated at Midland International was December 27, 2015, 7.6 inches. Temperatures are expected to warm up into the 50s on Thursday and into the 60s by Friday and Saturday. Doctor says, to feel safe, people need to know they're important. Midland Independent School District hosts 5th Annual Mental Health Conference. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. Midland ISD hosted its 5th Annual Mental Health Conference on Friday for school counselors, educators, and others who work with children. This year's conference centered around the polyvagal theory, which focuses on how the nervous system connects to social engagement, said Joelle Bracken, MISD's Student Behavioral Support Coordinator. Quote, it's really interesting and it's really helpful, she said, so we thought it would be helpful to our counselors, end quote. Dr. George Thompson was the keynote speaker at this year's event. Thompson is an expert in polyvagal theory and chief medical officer of a child behavioral health agency in Kansas City. He spoke about the three different states of the brain, which he described as safety, danger, and life threat. He says a person needs to feel safe for their brain to work properly and for them to display correct behaviors. Quote, a nervous system that's focused on danger can't focus on solutions, he said. It first needs to know that it's safe, end quote. Thompson said the main way counselors and educators can make patients and students feel safe is by demonstrating that they care about the other's experiences. They can do this by showing patients or students that they're important, he said. He also spoke about children in the community who might be traumatized after the August shootings in Midland and Odessa. Quote, if a dangerous thing happens to a group of people, we have to be more deliberate about connecting, he said. To help people heal from trauma, they must see that their experience matters and that they're not alone in their experience, he said. The rise of technology presents a challenge for those who work with children, he said. He said people are often disconnected from face-to-face communication, but face-to-face communication is what conveys signals of safety to others. After the keynote speech, there were training sessions on topics such as connecting with others, improving marriages, and working with children who have experienced traumas, Bracken said. She said one goal of the conference was to connect different service providers in the area who may need to collaborate in the future. Quote, sometimes it takes more than one agency to best serve a student or a family, she said. So we want those people meeting each other so that they can connect, end quote. The other goal, Bracken said, is to keep counselors current with what they've been trained in. Quote, This field is constantly changing, so our counselors need to be up to date on their skills and their knowledge so they can best serve kids, she said. Well-preserved property can save a town. This is analysis by Joe Hawley of the Houston Chronicle. Dateline Marathon. Listening recently to a talk by Gage Hotel owner J.P. Bryan on the occasion of his 80th birthday, my ears perked up toward the end of his remarks when he advised us all to get a smaller place, quote, because you probably live in only three rooms anyway, end quote. As soon as he said that, I thought of our unassuming second home cottage here in the little town that the Gage has made famous. The Wee House, as the previous owners christened it, has four Wee rooms. We basically live in three when we're out here. I sat up straighter. It sounded like me and the man who made his millions as a Houston oil and gas investor have something in common. On second thought, I wondered how well J.P. keeps his own advice. He and his wife, Mary John, are the owners of historic houses and buildings and the hotel in Marathon, two sprawling ranches and ranch homes near Big Bend National Park, a beach house, a couple of Victorian homes, and the Bryan Museum in Galveston, housed in the former Galveston Orphans Home a few blocks from the Strand, a luxury condominium high-rise in Houston, a house in Colorado Springs, and a graceful residential building that five Jewish families erected in 1918 on St. Charles Street in New Orleans. I think that's all. I may have missed a few as I scribbled notes during the slideshow accompanying his birthday party talk. I did write down that he began buying and restoring properties in 1980 when he acquired a small Greek Revival house in Round Top as a 40th birthday present for Mary John, a house where improvements through the decades concealed a log cabin. The Round Top house burned to the ground a few years after the Bryans gave it to their daughter in 1998. The historic furnishings were lost a year later when errant fireworks on New Year's Eve 2000 landed on the roof of the Marathon warehouse where they were stored and started a blaze. Even though I have a bit of catching up to do to match the quantity and quality of JP's real estate holdings, we have at least one other thing in common. We share a deep and abiding respect for the value and the pleasure of restoring and preserving. I can only admire from afar, but Bryan, the preservationist, without a doubt, has put his millions where his mouth is. He bought those houses, buildings, and ranches for the purpose of preserving and restoring pieces of the past that still had inherent value. Commercial value, maybe, or maybe someday. Soul-enhancing value, certainly. Still tall and lean as he enters his ninth decade, Bryan no longer runs marathons, although he still plays golf and is still working to preserve and restore. He's hoping to acquire the 2,300-acre Wolf Island in Galveston Bay, where the Brazos and San Bernard Rivers come together. As a kid, he often accompanied his grandmother, Catherine Cassie Perry Bryan, as she walked the beach near Freeport, planting poles in the sand where sea turtles had laid their eggs. The island, he said, quote, would be a beautiful, wonderful turtle sanctuary, end quote. He's also gotten involved in the battle to save an El Paso neighborhood near the Rio Grande called Duranguito, quote, the most historic site in all of El Paso, end quote. Established in 1827 by Ponce de Leon, a wealthy 19th-century El Paso merchant, not the 16th-century Spanish explorer, Duranguito, Little Durango, encompasses the archaeological remains of the city's first settlement. The neighborhood also is home to a 1930 Art Deco firehouse designed by renowned El Paso architect Henry Trost, who also designed the gauge. Brian reported that the city of El Paso is trying to bulldoze the area and build a minor league basketball arena. Quote, "It'll destroy everything," he said. The irony implicit in the effort to preserve history is that the primary reason an old building or a house or a neighborhood remains to be preserved is that nobody wanted it until they do. Brian was talking about Durán Quito, but he could have been talking about any number of Texas towns and cities, including San Antonio. The Alamo City's historical awakening is complicated, as Lewis Fisher details in his superb book, Saving San Antonio, The Precarious Preservation of a Heritage. But imagine what the city would be like today if women's groups and the San Antonio Conservation Society had not prevailed against efforts to plow under the city's Spanish architectural heritage and pave over the troublesome little stream that flowed through town. Had the preservationists lost to those intent on devouring the city's soul, to borrow Fisher's metaphor, I'm pretty sure San Antonio would not be welcoming more than 20 million overnight leisure visitors annually, according to an organization called Visit San Antonio, and the Riverwalk, that troublesome little stream, would not be the most popular tourist attraction in Texas. On a smaller scale, Brian could have been talking about Jefferson, the sleepy little town in northeast Texas where the city's fathers, in the name of progress, wanted to tear down the once gracious 19th century homes that lined leafy streets. The Women's Garden Club in the early 1960s said, "No way," and the women won. So did the town. Jefferson's impeccably restored homes, churches, and buildings, more than 60 structures are listed in the National Register of Historic Places, attract thousands of visitors yearly. Whatever the other virtues of the handsome little town, it's safe to say those visitors wouldn't be coming if not for the meticulous and ongoing attention to history. Brian would like to see something similar happen in this appealingly scruffy little town in the wilds of West Texas. He's working to make the whole of Marathon, even the Wee House, I suppose, a National Historic District. Quote, "A well-restored property," he told his birthday guests, "will resonate well beyond its walls and space. It will change a neighborhood, transform a historical district, bring new vitality to an entire community, or, as in the case of the Gage Hotel, save a small town," end quote.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. You can also hear this program anytime online at recordinglibrary.org or by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.